You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Q&A panel on reason, purpose, and self-esteem. With Yaron Brook, Ankar Gatte, Elan Giorno, and Aaron Smith.
So most talks so far have stressed that acts of charity and acts involving helping strangers need not be altruistic. They can be selfish to the extent that they are meaningful and valuable to the actor. So the problem is that I think all altruists would agree with that. All altruists would say that their acts of altruism, their selfless acts, are meaningful to them and that they are important to them. Obviously, it's important to help society and so on and so forth. So presumably, selfishness has very definite implications. It's not just a reformulation of altruism. So I would like to hear some further elaboration about where the line is drawn between a charitable act of egoism versus a charitable act of altruism. What is, for example, an action that would be considered definitely moral by an altruist, but a no-no by a rational egoist?
I don't think what differentiates an action that an altruist would think is right and an action that is other-related, like oriented toward another person that an objectivist would agree with, I don't think what differentiates the two is the specific action. Because I could take the same action from a motive of, this isn't important to me, it's a waste of my time, but I'm supposed to do it, and that'd be a sacrifice. And I could take the objectivist could take the same action and think of it as, this is not a sacrifice, this is, it's not to me, and it's a kind of an action that I would take. It's part of the way I like to interact with people. It's part of who I am, it's part of what's important to me. So I don't think what differentiates the action, part of it is it a sacrifice or not?
Yeah.
That's just one thing, but if anybody else.
I'm not crystal clear that I'm sure that I know what you're asking, but it's, so I don't think what's been said up on stage is charity is okay, it can fit into a rational view of your interest. That's part of what's said, but Yaron also stressed, which I agree with, that he said he's suspicious of most philanthropists because what they're doing is trying to satisfy an altruist standard of morality. So I don't think you put in the question as an altruist could agree with what's being said. Well, I don't think they're going to agree that altruism is evil, so they're not agreeing with everything that's being said, but they wouldn't even agree that is it meaningful? And part of what we were saying is not, the standard is not, is it meaningful to you to give this money? The question is, does it actually advance your self-interest? And that, an altruist will say, that's not relevant. That morally is not relevant. So the fact that an altruist might say, I feel good when I do this, is not the same as him saying, I'm advancing my self-interest in doing this. And for us, the issue is not, do you feel good or not? It's because you often should not feel good. The reason you say you feel good is you're trying to satisfy an altruist standard that you should be trying to reject. So the issue is, are you advancing your self-interest by donating money to this cause, helping this person? And that has to be the standard that you're trying to assess the action. And I think when many charitable acts don't meet that standard. They can meet that standard, but many don't. And it's, for many people, it's not the reason they're doing it.
So just to break that down a little bit. So it's meaningful for your life by a rational standard and within the context of a hierarchy of values. That is, if you're doing it unthinking, I'm just going to help him. Even if you feel good, that's not right because you could be spending that time on something that's more important to you. So it has to be within a hierarchy of values. You have to have a hierarchy of values. To be an egoist doesn't just mean going out there and doing what you feel like again. It's about thinking through, having a hierarchy of values, and pursuing those that are most important to you. And not sacrificing by taking on a lower value at the expense of a higher one. Right? So egoism really has requirements. It really is demanding of you real thought in terms of how to live. And for most of the charitable acts, if you actually really thought about it, you would say, nah. I think we'd still have some philanthropy in an objectivist world, in an egoistic world, but nowhere near as much. and different, completely different. And it's hard to imagine what it would look like because it would be oriented towards people, the individual's values. That would be the orientation, not towards what society expects of them, but towards what they truly value.
Thank you. These are good answers.
Comes.
So I got triggered when you told the Catalonians to cut it out and not secede. I mean, I'm an anarchist, I'm against all states, but I think there should be more states, not less, because we agree that free market is good and competition is good. So why not competition between states? I mean, there's a term called a rump state. It means that if Catalonia secedes, whatever will be left of Spain will be a rump state. And we know that Catalonians are left-wing. They are socialists. And your argument is that there will be less freedom in the world if there will be a new socialist state. But the rump state, the Spain, will be more free because there will be 8 million less leftist voters. Same as Great Britain. If Scotland secedes, there will be less people voting left because Scottish are leftists as well. Same as Quebec and Canada.
So I'm a Scot. Let's say I'm a Scot, and yeah. I don't want to secede. So you basically are okay with the majority imposing their will on the minority who doesn't want to secede because you're for liberty and freedom. No, you don't get to arbitrarily decide these things. And by the way, the same thing works in economics. Your argument is an argument for breaking up big tech. The state should intervene to break up big tech. A majority of people, maybe we should all vote on how many big tech companies there should be. And let's break up big tech because perfect competition is better than... All these arguments are bogus. The whole issue of secession is a non-issue. It's a bogus issue. The only reason to secede as a political entity is to establish more freedom. If you're not trying to establish more freedom, there's no moral right to impose your will on the minority any more than any other government action has a right to impose will on the minority.
So there will be more freedom in Spain if Catalonia secedes.
There will not be more freedom in Spain. It's what you anarchists do. You play mind games, abstract mind games that are disassociated from the actual reality of life. And... you know, it just doesn't work that way, and it doesn't work in logic that way, and it certainly doesn't work in reality that way.
Okay.
Hello? Okay.
Sorry, I get anarchy question in every Q&A I ever do, and I lose my patience, so I apologize.
So here we talk about Ayn Rand and objectivist society, and we don't have empirical evidence where the objectivist society was. As well as there is not empirical evidence where anarcho-capitalism was. So your guess that Guy with big guns wins is just your prediction, which can be wrong.
So I think there is evidence. So there's evidence both for anarchy and both and for what it would look like to have an objectivist system. So the... Yaron said he views the Declaration of Independence as the best political document in the history of mankind, and that's how Ayn Rand viewed it as well. And it's putting forth a new view of government, which objectivism essentially agrees with. There are certain things that we think are flaws, both in the Declaration in a certain sense, certainly in the Constitution, that was adopted to try to secure the basic principles of the Declaration and to have a new form of government dedicated to protecting rights. But it came close, and it was the best system the world has ever seen. And the progress in the U.S. Yeah. in the 19th century is the most astonishing progress economically and culturally. If you look at where America was in the late 1700s to where it gets to in the early 1900s, the world has never seen such. So that's part of the evidence. And then there's all kinds of evidence to the extent that other places emulated the United States, like Hong Kong, say, or someone brought up Singapore, and adopted some of these principles, you had incredible prosperity. And there's no such thing as anarcho-capitalism. It's just there's no referent in reality to it. So you say, well, it hasn't been tried. So it can't be tried. It doesn't. There is no such thing. But there is anarchy. And anarchy has existed all over the world in many times and places. If anarchy just means you don't have a monopoly on the use of force in a geographical area, so people are competing in the use of force, this has been, I mean, the Middle Ages in Europe, there's all kinds of pockets of anarchy where you don't really, you have one gang that comes in and takes stuff from the peasants, and then you have another gang that comes. There's no monopoly on the use of force. There's just gang warfare. And that's what anarchy is. Anarchy is you're forming your own gang and saying, we're going to use force how we say we're going to use force, and the other gang is going to use force how they say they're going to use force. And Ayn Rand was asked about the anarchy, and she said, oh, you mean like the mafia, where you have warring gangs, I mean literally gangs, that are fighting each other. And that's what anarchy is. And that's what you see whenever you don't have a monopoly on the use of force. You have competing people. And competing, if you're going to win at the use of force, an individual wielding force doesn't win. So you have to get into a gang. And so people form into gangs. It's what you see with the cartels in regard to drugs. You've seen it all over Africa. It happened. So anarchy has been tried over and over and over again. And it's the idea that you would rather live in anarchy than in 19th century America, or even 21st century America, you're crazy. You're literally crazy if you think that's a better place to live. And it's been tried over and over. So I think there's evidence for both systems. Anarchy is not a system. It's just you don't have a monopoly. So you have gangs fighting, hoping one is trying to become a monopoly on the use of force, and not a good monopoly, a bad, because the principles by which it would use force is really bad. But you've had that all over the world. So the idea that anarchy has not been tried I don't think that is true.
I just want to add one quick thing about that, which is, it's remarkable that some people who advocate for anarchy are really resistant to recognizing its actual phenomenon in the world. So you give examples of Africa, and I mean, go to Libya. After the fall of Gaddafi, and that's not very far in the past, people are still dealing with the aftermath. Go to the Palestinian territories in the last 10 years. It's literally neighborhood-to-neighborhood police forces. And within the Palestinian Authority, I happen to know about this because I wrote a book about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and it is really ugly. I mean, people, what does it look like to have justice in anarchy? I can tell you can read about it in the Wall Street Journal. There was a story about rival Palestinian police forces, loyal to different factions and different sects. They grab someone who they claim committed a crime, and they shoot him in the head in the street. That is what anarchy justice looks like. So it's really important when we think about political issues I agree. Let's look at the empirical evidence and recognize it when you see it, and not behave as if, well, we never tried this because our particular version of this is not. That is not at all the way to think about it. And it's just, these things have to have a referent in the world if they mean anything. And if you look at the world, it's really horrendous. No, if you ask, where would you like to live? Would you like to live under anarchy? Well, go try it. I'll buy the ticket for you if you want to see. It's really messy. It's not at all what it means to have a free society. And just recognizing that, I think, is a big step in being empirical. Let's do that.
Okay, thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
So my question is, whenever you give the introductory talks, trying to explain the essence of objectivism in a nutshell, you always make this distinction between egoism and altruism. And even though I understand that, I know that it is really important to make it, but I guess among the people who are new here and who are new to the philosophy, it creates some misunderstanding after they hear the talk in terms of what it actually means to promote your life, to enhance your life. And in this sense, so wouldn't it be more correct or more clear to try to make them understand that the life basically has its objective requirements, and that the human as a being has a nature, and so from that to derive that life should be the standard. So it could be more clear. Wouldn't it be more clear to make them understand what promoting life actually means? Thanks.
Well, part of the thing, part of the what we're trying to achieve here is to approach this at a less, I think, technical level. I think we did address some parts of that issue, that it's about life, it's about the requirements of your life, that the good is essentially the pro-life, and that's a less technical way of putting it, but that's the pro-life, and that the evil or the bad is the anti-life. It's what thwarts and hinders life. So we indicated that there is an issue of a standard. But part of what we're trying to do, too, is motivate interest in reading more Ayn Rand. And if you look at her essay in The Virtue of Selfishness, called The Objectivist Ethics, she lays out her case for why she thinks life is the standard of value, what the kinds of virtues, and defines the virtues, and what kind of virtues that are required for the life, and why, its relationship to other living organisms, and the whole pursuit of life. So part of what we hope to do is not to necessarily answer all those questions in a particular talk, but to motivate people to look more into Rand for that. The point is, it's relevant. That's an important aspect of the life. I don't know if it's...
Yeah, so I'm sympathetic to the question. And if we had more time, we would go into some of those issues, because that really is the foundation of the objectivist view of morality. But the reason we talk about altruism and selfishness, and the reason I think Ayn Rand did, and you can see this in her intro to The Virtue of Selfishness, she says there, this is not the essential issue in morality. This is a secondary issue, and in a certain way, it's a side issue. Who's the beneficiary? If you know where values come from and why, the issue of who's the beneficiary falls out readily. But altruism has made it the issue in morality. And unless you take that head on and say both the concepts of altruism and the concept of selfishness distort your thinking, you can't think with the concepts as you have them. You can't get beyond people's misunderstandings about morality and thinking, I mean, this is part of what Aaron talked about, that morality and altruism are synonyms. They mean the same thing. They don't mean anywhere close to the same thing. But almost everybody thinks, well, morality means sacrificing for something else that's not me. That's what morality is. How did it get here? Who knows? And unless you really address that, no, she's saying, it's not true that morality means altruism. That is a view about morality. It's not a very good view. You've never been given reasons for it. The basic reason you're given for it is don't be selfish. But that's because they caricatured what selfishness means, and it means being a brute and so on. Don't be that, so I guess the only alternative is to be an altruist. That's how the argument runs. And unless you get people out of that framework, they'll never be able to think about morality afresh, I think, and that's part of why it's an introductory issue in a context where altruism dominates morality.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hello again. I have another question about government, but it's not the same one. And it's a real question. Everyone has the same rights. So we have universal rights. And the idea of government must be taken that government is an institute which is not made up of people. So there are people in government, and they say that they have a right to hold this monopoly on force, and other people do not have this right. So I was wondering, how does one get this monopoly? What does one have to do to achieve this right which other people do not have? Because you're starting from a point where we are now. Oh, what if we want to? If some northern province wants to secede from the rest of the country, and there are people in the northern province who don't agree, but it might also be that the country next to it is made up of four times as many people, and they could also have a democracy and vote that they will take over this smaller country. So we could end up with a world government. And there could be a majority ruling for that. So how do we get from get there? And then another thing is that you're saying that there's no anarchist society anywhere. You can try it, but actually, can you provide a country in reality which does protect rights? Because then I want to live there. I'm not free in any country in the world today or anywhere or any time.
So
your reality is not on your side either.
No, reality is clearly on the side, and Ankar gave good examples. We're not saying anarchy
doesn't. Where should I go?
We're not saying anarchy doesn't exist. We're saying the opposite. That anarchy exists right now on this earth. It exists in Libya, it exists in the Palestinian Authority, it exists in Somalia, and you're free to go there and experience so-called freedom and anarchy. So it's plenty. Right now, we're in a period where we're moving away from freedom. So yes, our kind of world is, we're moving away from that kind of world. There was a period in the 19th century in America where we came close. There was a period in 20th century Hong Kong where we came close. And most of us, a lot of us, moved to America because exactly that. And indeed, millions and millions of people went to America not to experience anarchy, not to experience socialism,
not
to experience statism, but to experience the relative freedom that America provided with its government. And millions of people did that.
You should research the Wild West then.
The Wild West was
not wild, and which was anarchy.
Enough. The Wild West was not anarchy. And again, you guys should really research, instead of reading the same people over and over again, the same little clique of Rothbardians, you really need to read history about what the Wild West
is.
Believe me, you would not want to live in the Wild West.
You didn't know Gustave de Molinari when I told you about him just 5 minutes ago.
Yes, I know all the authors. I know them all. I've read them. They're wrong. They teach a history that is just not correct. The Wild West, when the sheriff came to town, it was called, we're civilizing the Wild West, because they brought civilization, which means they brought government. They brought the rule of law. They brought a sheriff to regulate and to eliminate the gang warfare that was the Wild West. The Wild West was not romance. Even in the Westerns, the romance of the Wild West is about the sheriff coming in and cleaning up and organizing and creating order and bringing the rule of law to the place and putting up a sign, no guns allowed in a city. That was progress. That was civilization.
Why does the sheriff have this right?
Now, you asked, where's the starting point?
Yes.
Well, the starting point, we've got an example of that. And again, Ankar gave the example of that. The starting point, the best example of a starting point was the United States. They seceded.
Yeah, but who has this right?
You can't dominate the mic. I will not answer your question if you continue like this. All right?
Okay.
The United States had seceded, and they established a Declaration of Independence. They elected representatives within it. It wasn't democratic. They didn't vote on it democratically. It was removed from the people, from the masses. Then they wrote a constitution, and they voted on a constitution. And that's what was implemented. Now, because what was implemented was a pro-freedom agenda that had moved civilization towards more freedom, people didn't object. And if people did object, what they were objecting was to freedom. And they had a mechanism by which if you objected and you wanted even more freedom, you could use that mechanism, it's called the Constitutional Republic, to move the country towards more freedom, as the abolitionists did. The country was founded with a massive contradiction, which was slavery. And then people advocated to eliminate slavery, advocated for more freedom. And they got it. They fought for it intellectually and ultimately militarily, and we got freedom. So the model exists out there in terms of how you do it. And at the end of the day, whether you like it or not, what freedom depends on is having intellectuals, having philosophers of law, having philosophers of history, having people who understand the world, like the founding fathers of America, who sit down in a room and write a constitution. And if you don't have that, what you get is anarchy, which is constant, non-ending violence in the streets. And again, there are plenty of places historically and in the present where anarchy is being tried, where there's no constitution, there's no rule of law.
Next question, please.
Hello.
Hi.
I hope my question is going to be a little bit less historical and political. My question is surrounding the topic of debate. modern times, and how objectivist pursued that problem of devaluation of truth, because I see that debate gets more and more heated. I don't mean the current debate here, but generally speaking in public. And how do we try to convince people to use facts instead of emotions in terms of discussion, and how objectivists view this problem and the solution for it?
I'm not sure if I entirely understand the question.
I see that the modern debate is getting more and more heated, and emotions are becoming the arguments.
So let me try to answer in this sense. At the end of the day, it's about education. And part of the education is in how to engage in a debate and how to be rational and how to look at facts. This is why, for example, our discussion earlier about education is so crucial. Because if our educational system teaches people not to think, or how to unthink, or then it's very hard to have that debate, because all they have left is emotion. So part of the issue is an epistemological issue of helping people think properly and engage in thought and revolutionizing education so people learn how to think in school, so they want facts, so they want evidence, so they want to think about the issues, not just emote about them. There's no way, I think, to circumvent that fact, that if the culture out there is an unthinking culture, we need to teach them how to think, and maybe we need to start very young in order to do that, and education.
Yeah, and you need to point that out, that this is what's going on. It's rampant emotionalism. It's not intellectual. It's not argument. People aren't really thinking. And I think when you talk about universities and the kind of like shouting down professors and turning your back and chanting and making noise to prevent debates, is a university administrator, this needs to be shut down. You can protest intellectually, but this is the shutting down of the intellect. And if that happens in institutions of learning and it goes unchecked without any opposition from administration or from professors or from other students, you're going to get more of that.
It's not, though, an issue. You put it as debate is heated. In America, it will often be put, it's polarized. That is not the right way to conceptualize what is going on. So if there's a problem, the problem is it's the debate is irrational, emotionalistic. There's no real arguments being given.
That's the case I'm making.
But there's a reason it's conceptualized as it's heated, polarized, because it's an attempt, and this happened throughout the 20th century, certainly in America, to silence any kind of what they would put as extreme view, but what that really means is any principled position in politics. If you go back to, say, we've been talking about the founding of America, you look at the debates and how heated they were, and how polarized, let's say the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists in the U.S., it makes today look pretty benign. But they're giving arguments. That's the difference. It's a real argument between the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist, not two people shouting at each other. And what you have today, and you're bringing up the campuses, is the students, they're just shouting. And there's in the U.S., there's been real examples of a professor saying, okay, now, do you want to actually hear the other side of this? And do you want to hear my view? And they just keep shouting, because they're not interested in facts or argument. That's the issue, not that it's a heated debate or it's polarized. These are important issues, and there's reasons why it would be heated.
So I think the correct phrasing of my question would be, how do we change the arguments from irrational to the rational ones?
Expect arguments. And if you don't get them, I don't know, leave them
call
alone.
Call it out.
Yeah, call it out.
You got to point out that what's being done is irrational.
I think I have a practical answer for my question, but how do you perceive it in the matters of philosophy? Why? Because behind every single action of human being underlies some kind of philosophy. So what philosophy is causing people to want more irrational arguments instead of facts?
I think it's the undermining of reason, the philosophical trend of undermining reason and facts and reality. So it comes out of a long tradition of negating the efficacy of reason.
It's interesting. Ayn Rand has several essays that deal with this kind of phenomenon as she observed it in her own time. And I think we're seeing the progression of it. And she called it the anti-conceptual mentality. I don't know if you've read it. She has an essay called The Missing Link, if you're interested in reading it. And what's, I think this is really the sort of the core of a lot of what we see people call tribalism, and this idea that you can have your own facts, and that, well, I don't like your facts, I'm going to make up my own facts, and that's not how things work.
Yeah, but a little bit simplifying the let's problem I'm trying to talk about, because actually the works that you've mentioned was my original reason to ask this question, because there was this like psychological side of the problem, but what is the philosophical drive behind it?
But I think it's what Yaron says. It's to understand it. It didn't happen in the last 10 years. It's not new. And to see, it's to understand how these things work over time is a philosophical phenomenon, and it has psychological aspects. I don't think it's essentially a psychological issue. It has to do with how people use their mind, how they think, and it's wrapped up with psychology, but it's important to get that the primary cause is the idea that's been pounded into people for 200 years is that the human mind is not capable of dealing with the world. And as a result, you need to be controlled by other people. You need a government to tell you what to do. You need a dictator. And you're not competent to look at the facts. There's this whole progression. And it's not stopped. It's still going on. I mean, it's dominant. Elements of this are dominant in academia. So to me, to go back to what Yaron said, I completely agree with that. I think it's to understand the source of it is it runs through the education and intellectual world. And the way to address it is both to name it, expose it, and shame it, in effect, because there are better people looking, and they're looking for kind of a pushback. And then the fundamental way to solve it is to put better ideas in front of people and to tell them, no, this is actually the way to have discourse. If you want to convince people, you need to give them arguments. You can't just shout them down, and that's not how civilization works. I mean, those are just, I think, the beginnings of it. Yeah.
So just not having a compromise with the irrational.
Yeah, you should never compromise with the irrational. Mm. Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you all for these talks. Onkar, in the morning you were talking about reason, purpose, self-esteem, and I think these three concepts talk about perennial need of man, and I think that because also Christianity has similar, has answers in a really radical different way, the same needs with hope, charity, and faith. Mm-hmm. What do you think are these needs of human beings for these kind of answers?
That's a good question.
So where does the need for these arise? Is that...
Why are these concepts of... Why reason, purpose, and self-esteem core concepts in the Ayn Rand's ethics?
Because they're about your fundamental relationship to the world. So reason is your means of knowing things. It's your means of the discovery, identification of facts. It's how you reach knowledge. Purpose is for what are you going to use this knowledge for? What is your goal? What are you pursuing? Or what should you be pursuing? So, and self-esteem then is an evaluation of, am I succeeding in the world? And her perspective is you're succeeding if you are gaining knowledge and have the right goals. So that's the sense in which they form a unity. So it's about thought and action, but thought and action in the world and getting the feedback of, am I succeeding in the world or am I failing in some kind of way? And so these are three, she talks about these are the three cardinal values of our moral system. This is what you have to achieve if you're going to live a human life. And there's all kinds of detail then of what a particular human life looks like. But these are fundamentals that in some sense anyone has to be on if they're pursuing life. They have to be pursuing knowledge, they have to be pursuing the right goals, and they have to then have a self-assessment of themselves as, yeah, I am on the right course for these reasons. That is, I'm fulfilling what reason and purpose require of a human life. So that's, in a nutshell, I think her perspective of why these are the fundamental needs and so fundamental values that you have to achieve if what you're interested in is a human life.
And I think the reason you need any kind of fundamentals or these kind of principles or these kind of values is because man is a conceptual being and does not have it programmed. We don't know what to do, how to gain knowledge, what we should do with our lives. What's our relationship? We have to figure it out. So, and this is why religion has to have those principles too. Any philosophy, any way, any you know, people are seeking why religion served an important purpose. Religion is not just some arbitrary thing that came. Human beings need guidance. We're not all geniuses who can figure this out for ourselves. We need guidance on how to live, on what actions we should take, and how to understand the world and how to gain knowledge from the world. And Ayn Rand talked about religion being a primitive form of philosophy. So it provided some answers. We think wrong answers for the most part, but it provided some answers. And then philosophy comes around and looks for reality for the answers, looks at human nature for answers rather than looks for some kind of revelation for answers. So it's still, you know, we need guidance, which is because of our nature. Our nature is not of having free will and not being coded with the right answers.
Yeah, so human beings don't need religion. They need perspective on guidance in their life.
Yep.
And to the extent that religion offers something like that, it offers something of value, but we need to upgrade to something rational in terms of the actual content that's being offered. And it doesn't mean that because it's a philosophy that it's good or that it's rational, but you need to move away from a more primitive form of that guidance.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Hi. So recently, animal rights groups and vegans and these kind of people have started being more aggressive in their advocacy for animal rights, and because they claim animals have reason, citing these kind of scientific studies when they say animals have some kind of consciousness or self-awareness, stuff like that. So as a consequence of that, animals should receive rights as humans. So what is your take on these claims? Should animals have rights because they have reason, or...
I'm not an animal psychologist, so I won't weigh in on that, but I think it's ridiculous.
So you're weighing in on after all.
Yeah, because you don't have to be an animal psychologist.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's really ridiculous. Really ridiculous. And I'm an animal lover. One thing really infuriates me is the way people can mistreat animals. So I'm not totally on the side of animals. On the other hand, the rights... How's Fido gonna respect rights? Your dog, right? It can't understand rights. It can't conceptualize them. It doesn't formulate goals and principles of action that it needs freedom to function, and it could somehow respect your rights. And oh, I'm sorry, I did that on your lawn. I wouldn't want you to do that. They can't conceptualize that. They don't need them. They wouldn't know what to do with them. They couldn't respect them. And so they're outside of the framework of the concept of rights. That does not mean that it's right, good, or proper to just treat them like a piece of paper and just like they're nothing, you can do whatever you want with them. That's not at all. I mean, I think real animal cruelty is an indication of a really sick person. I don't mean literally sick, like they're crazy or something, but I think it's evil. But that doesn't mean it's an issue of rights. It's an issue of property rights to the extent that if I purchase a pet and I provide for its sustenance, and it's like, I don't think of myself as an owner, like it's like I own a piece of paper, right? But it's that legally, I am. I purchased, I provide for its sustenance and stuff, and it's an issue of property rights if somebody else comes over and harms my dog. So there is an issue of rights involved, but it's not human rights.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I am going to weigh in on the psychology a little bit. I've read a little bit about it, and I also think it's ridiculous from a different perspective. So they don't have a real concept of reason. Yeah. That you can find for some of the higher animals, chimpanzees and stuff, some little ability to abstract is not what it means when we say man is the rational animal. What you don't find in the animal world is the discovery of knowledge and the passing of it down from generation to generation to building a civilization. And that's kind of the pre-context of where you get rights. Rights is a very sophisticated context, a concept of how to deal with people in a civilized society. And animals don't have anything like that. And so they don't have anything like the ability to reason in the human sense. And you don't need all these studies to see, Look, they don't have schools, they don't have education, they're not even at the level of making stone tools or anything like that, which we think of as pre-civilization of human beings. So they're not anywhere at the level of the way human beings operate. And to just think of it as, well, we have reason and they have reason, it's you don't have a concept of reason if that's how you're thinking about it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hello.
Hey.
How can I use reason to judge what is true in highly esoteric, nuanced, and abstract subjects that I have no expertise in, such as the sciences or economics, particularly when two experts in the same field have completely different viewpoints? So, for example, how can I judge the veracity of Einstein's general relativity without having gone through the requisite education in higher mathematics in my busy life? How can I look at the evidence without understanding it?
Well, go ahead. I was just going to say, you can't.
Yeah, you can't.
You can't. I mean, I don't know enough about, and I've studied theory of relativity because I was an engineer in a previous life, and I didn't understand it. I have no way of saying in a first-handed way that it's true or that it's untrue. Now, there are people I know in certain realms that I have some trust in, and therefore, you know, I'm willing to count on their advice like I do for my doctor and other things, but there's certain things I just don't know. And sometimes in life, many times in life, it's really, really crucial to say, I don't know. I the science is complicated, the economic argument is complex, whatever it happens to be, that I don't know. And now that doesn't apply to politics, because politics is something that is within all of our grasp. It does apply to technical, esoteric, scientific issues. A lot of times we have to be willing to say, don't know.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. You figure out what it is that you do understand, so you only understand what you understand. And you're only qualified to judge where you have the elements, the evidence available, that you can put it together and say, yeah, no, I get this. Or I get an aspect of this, but I don't know the rest. And that's where you are. And if you have a real interest in, no, there's a real need for me, I need to figure this out. It's not like, is the number, total number of stars odd or even? There's no reason to go into that. But it's, if there's something that's really important, then you look more into it. And I think even if you start to look to some experts in a field, your reliance on or experts in a field should be fundamentally non-authoritarian. Like you rely on them because the scientists say, every time I hear scientists say, it tells me nothing.
Exactly, yeah.
Absolutely nothing. And until you understand what the issues are, because that's often an appeal to authority, you know? Yeah, so, yeah.
Thank you. Good.
I have a question about social structure and specifically the size of political units. What's the appropriate size of political units? And so I'd like to hear your view on this and just kind of be a bit more specific about what I mean. The way I understand individual rights, it is a certain view on what is primary, the individual or some larger political unit like the state or a group of some sort. And the concept of rights basically says the individual comes first and no other authority, regardless who or what it is, has the right to violate the rights of the individual. So the individual is primary. And within social organization, the way one implements this right is this concept of subsidiarity. In other words, the individual can pass authority upwards to a group or a state and so on, but it's only delegated, it's not given away. So the individual can take back that right when he feels that this group or state no longer represents their interest. And this is actually implemented in various ways in different countries through like federal systems that then cooperate, the states cooperate or counties within a state. Switzerland has this developed to a very high degree. In fact, the cantons can change their borders. Just 30 years ago, more or less, one of them changed. In fact, just recently, another one changed their borders. They have a vote about it and they change it. Liechtenstein, which is next to Switzerland, small country, has gone even further. They've given the right, the explicit right of secession to any of the communities within the country. The smallest of those communities is just 400 people, 400 people. And they have the right to have a vote, and if they decide they want to be a separate country, they have the right to do that. That's in the Constitution. And what's interesting to me is that the countries that have more rights for individuals do the best. This freedom actually leads to stability. So paradoxically, the right that they have, the right to exit, actually prevents exit because it prevents abuse of power. So there's no reason to exit. But when you try and force people to stay within this political unit, you're suppressing how they want things to be run, and that gives them more right to try and secede. So back to the question of what is the appropriate size of political units. If we look empirically, right through the world, the smaller units actually have more freedom. They are more economically and socially successful, generally speaking. There's always exceptions. And the bigger ones abuse their power more. Back to the Lord Acton famous quote, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So I would be very, very skeptical of large political units like the Soviet Union. After the breakup, we've got more smaller units. And yes, not everything is perfect. But many of those smaller units, like some of the Baltics, actually have more freedom now than they used to in the past. Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Hong Kong, Singapore. Singapore is also a secession. Hong Kong was a breakaway from China. The small units abuse their power less than the bigger ones, generally speaking. So, curious to hear you.
I would challenge almost everything you said, I think. I would challenge almost everything you said, both theoretically in terms of the way to conceive of rights, but also even in terms of the empirical evidence. Yes, once the Soviet Union broke up, you had more freedom, but look at the starting point. If you broke up America, the United States of America today, you'd have less freedom. The states would vote for more intervention. If suddenly the Bill of Rights disappeared at the federal level, there would be lots of hate speech laws all over the United States and little states in the United States, and it would go away. So the starting point matters, you know, whether you're starting off with relative freedom or you're starting off with the most awful dictatorship in human history. Yes, once you get rid of the awful dictatorship in human history, you get more freedom, almost by definition, no matter what kind of nature the breakup would have materialized in. I also think to use Liechtenstein and to use little countries around Europe like this, which completely depend on larger countries and all kinds of international agreements that allow them to exist for a variety of historical weird reasons, I think it's just not useful for a real empirical discussion about what works and what doesn't historically. And I would never call Hong Kong breaking away from China. Hong Kong was taken by the British and imposed on Hong Kong a very British rule of law. So it's not a secession. It was a takeover, you know, with a lease agreement, which the Chinese had no choice but to sign, you know, which is good because I think they did a good job in Hong Kong. So the whole way of approaching this, even about designating rights, I think is wrong. I don't think that's how you approach it. In a civilized society, when man comes in within a group, one has to extract the use of force from those relationships. And government is the monopoly over the use of force in that area. And a monopoly like that always arises, whether it arises through gang warfare, and ultimately one of the gangs wins, and it becomes the monopoly over the use of force over time, or through a more peaceful process like, you know, the creation of states, as we've seen. What is the optimal size of a state? I don't know. It's not small. It's not small. And, you know, we'll see 20 years from now as the European Union disintegrates, what it disintegrates into and what are the state of those states is going to be. I'm not as optimistic as some of you are with that regard. I suspect that it's fairly large, that the optimal size is fairly large, because there's massive benefits to having one standardized legal system over a particular geographic area. There are massive benefits to the free movement of capital, labor, and capital, labor, What am I missing? Goods and goods.
Sorry,
in a particular area.
Short clarification. Yeah. I'd like to distinguish between political centralization and economic integration. So I'm absolutely in favor of economic integration, but not political centralization.
But the whole point of political segregation is control and power at the local level. And almost always, in almost all cases, those little political units want control over economic freedom. And they do. They take control over their little economic fiefdom. And it's an achievement. I'm not saying it's impossible. But an achievement for all those little units to come together and establish free movement of labor, capital, and goods. That is rare, though, in human history that they actually do that. And there's a movement right now led by Donald Trump to move us away from that kind of situation. So what is the optimal size? I don't know. I don't know that there's any way to tell. It depends on history. It depends on location. It depends on geography. It depends on a lot of different things. But I've advocated for much fewer countries than 220. I think a few big, 50 countries. I don't know. It's completely arbitrary in that sense. It's the principle that matters. I mean, it would be cool if we had one free country. Anybody want one free country? We could then all move there. That would be, we'd start there. But we don't. Even Liechtenstein and even these small places are limited in very much in the scope of what freedom means and for whom there is freedom in those places. So I don't know if you have, if you guys have a...
Well, I'll just say one, I think, other context is relevant to thinking about this whole issue and the kind of history of it is the U.S., which is a huge country, enormously powerful. Think of secession in the 19th century. The slave states wanted to split. Would that have been more freedom, or would that have been less freedom? And also, to the extent that we have freedom in the world today, how much is it due to the U.S.? And the fact that the U.S. was a massive and powerful country. I mean, my view is that Europe would not be here. You guys got bailed out. Europe was bailed out by the United States in World War II. And if you didn't have that, it would be communist, Nazi, and you would have Japan maybe as well. And there would be so much less freedom without the United States. And the United States was able to do what it did because it's a big united country, not Liechtenstein.
Although the formation of the United States was when there was the British Empire, which was the big global empire, and then the United States was just a very small geography, very few people actually compared to what the modern U.S. is, and that seceded.
But size wasn't the issue.
Yeah, it wasn't size, and again, if you secede for the purpose of greater liberty, all the power to you. You're going to have to fight for it. You're going to have to fight a revolution as the Americans did. And if you seceded today to establish liberty, you're going to have to fight to get there. It's not going to be, oh, I secede, and everybody's going to say, great, goodbye, see you later. No, you're going to have to fight for it. If you're fighting for greater liberty, then it's a moral cause. It's a good cause because you're fighting for freedom. To secede for any other purpose, which is most of the secessions in the world, Scotland wants to be more socialist. Catalonia wants to be more socialist. Those are not moral or good or virtuous. They don't move us towards greater freedom. They move us away from it. So while the United States started small, it gained its real might when it got big. And when it got big, it was, in spite of, I know, a lot of things that people write, it was a force for good in the world. I mean, Ankar mentioned World War II. You'd still be fighting World War I probably if the United States had intervened. And I have no idea why we intervened in that one. That one we had no excuses for. We should have let you guys fight it. So the history matters. And ignoring the role the United States has had over the last 200 years in international politics and being a beacon for freedom, being a shiny city on a hill for so many people, including Solidarity here in Poland during the 1980s, and thinking of the United States, even though it was a romanticized it, thinking of it as a place of freedom, even though it wasn't that free, thinking of it, because in relative term it was, so inspired people who were being oppressed to seek out. And I don't think that would have happened again if the beacon of freedom was Liechtenstein. It just wouldn't have served that purpose. Here was an experiment that worked on a large scale. And one of the great tragedies of the last 100 years is that we're turning our backs on the experiment. We're turning our backs on the freedom that the United States showed us works.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have about 15 minutes left for this Q&A. There's another one tomorrow. So what I'd love to do is let's get through more questions, and we'll try to keep the question. I mean, I think it's really valuable, so I don't want to forestall the discussion. But more questions, more answers, and let's see if we can get through everyone who's in the line. Yes, miss.
Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. I wanted to ask you, this will be, I hope, a simpler question. We talked about how the major objectivist principles are finding your purpose, building your self-esteem, and also the starting point is you. And we talked about the consequences of you don't want to live a life where you're 50 years old and you lived under a burden that tradition, family, the state that you live in, put on you. But I wanted to ask you, the main question is when? If that happens, then what do you do? Because I see the vast majority here are younger people, and also you have seen this, I say, this vast, how should I say it? It's expansion of objectivism and the principles that have been implemented. I'm from Montenegro, I'm from the Balkans, and this objectivism is a new idea there, but I was really interested in seeing how it would be implemented in a country and also in a region that is really into unity as a part of their culture. So what happens if you're 50 and you then realize what is your purpose then, but you have circumstances that are not really in your favor? We also talked about, I want to also say hi to Mr. Robert from Netherlands, a scholar that we talked about, what is the main point? Actually, if you are in a environment, do you want to change so you can change the environment or move somewhere that will actually give you those circumstances that will give you the chance to find your purpose and actually fulfill your happiness so the pursuit of happiness is complete?
So first I'd say the purpose of having an objectivist morality is not to change the world. It's to live the best life you can. It's to make the changes in you and in your life. And if you're 50 and you want to change Montenegro, it's not happening. As much as I love Montenegro, it takes a long time. Political change takes a long time. So if you're 50 and you discover these ideas and you've got ideas of what you want to do in life, then find the best place in the world and go there to where you can live the best life that you can live. So, don't let your geography limit you. There's a whole world out there, and find the best possible. The other thing is, the older you get, the harder it is. There's no question, because the more you've automated, the more you're part of a particular world, the more culturally you're within something, and the harder it becomes. And why we focus so much on young people is it's easier for them to be radical and to change things and to move their life in a completely new direction and so on. So it's definitely a greater challenge the older you are when you discover these ideas. Yet it's never too late, but it is harder.
Okay. I just wanted to follow up on that. But what if, like, the pursuit of happiness that you want to fulfill, right? And it requires making changes in your environment. Then is it worth it? And if everyone is pursuing their own happiness, why would they work together so they want to find their own requirements there and not to go away?
Well, I mean, that depends on what you think you can accomplish and what the time span is. If you think, if I devote the next 5 years, I can create the kind of conditions, at least in my local environment, to allow me to pursue my happiness. If you have really good reasons to think that you can do that, then it's probably worth the effort. And what's the time span? What's your interest? And because sometimes it might be, ideally I'd like to implement this here, but this is not really going to happen. I'm going to try to do it elsewhere if I can.
But let me just because I think this is an important question. It's... depends what you mean by environment. So there's a political environment, and I'm pretty pessimistic about being able to change much in the political environment in the short run. But I have a sense that part of what you're challenging is there's another form of environment, which is your family, the people you associate, the people around you. And you have
In general.
Yeah, I mean, in both cases, but I'm sure there are a lot of people here that, suddenly I've got these radical ideas, but I've got a family. What about the family? Particularly if you're older, you might have husband, you might have kids, And you have to be realistic about what is possible to change, who it's possible to change. And sometimes you have to be very courageous and set out on a new path in life alone. And it's hard and it's not easy, but sometimes you're in an environment where that is the only option you have if you're going to pursue your happiness. So you have to really evaluate the cost and benefit of the different paths that you're going to take and what is truly in your rational self-interest over the long run.
Okay, thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
So you asked if there was a country that advanced as much as USA after secession. There was one, Rhodesia, north of South Africa. And now I've got a question for you. So you gave Russia a lot of flack.
I gave what?
Russia. You gave Russia a lot of flack.
Yeah.
For doing the same things the USA does. Example, Georgia.
Yeah.
So why did you defend USA? You said USA was better than Russia.
Yeah, it's 1,000 times better. You want to live life in Moscow versus live life in New York, and you can
not
see
the,
what it's
not
like.
Not the general life, but what they do to other countries.
Well, but general life matters a huge amount, right? Most of what a country does, most of what a government does, it does to its own people. And if you look at what Russia does to its own people and what America does to its own people, the choice is pretty obvious. But even when it comes to what it does to other countries, there is a vast difference between what American foreign policy and the Russian foreign policy. Now, let me caveat this by, I am no defender of American foreign policy. But to compare the two, give me a break.
Let me finish. Okay.
Georgia, when Russia invaded Georgia, Georgia was a relatively free country. It actually was on the path to becoming one of the freest countries in Europe. Shashvili, I can't pronounce his name, so I apologize. But was prime minister, and you were heading towards a pretty free marketplace. And they invaded a free country that had done nothing militarily against them. Now, the United States, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, has invaded countries, and I've been critical when they've done it often, but they've invaded countries that are not free. The idea that you would compare Saddam Hussein's Iraq to Georgia is absurd. The Iraqis should be thanking Allah that Americans invaded them and got rid of the monster that they had. Now, I'm not saying America should have done it, because I don't think America should be the policeman of the world. I don't think it's the job of American kids to die for the freedom of Iraqis. But from a Iraqi perspective, it's a vast improvement to be occupied for a little period of time by Americans than it is to live under Saddam Hussein. So it is a massive difference. And as far as I know, America has not invaded any free countries. Can't think of any. What's that? And so there's a massive difference between the two. The same happened with Ukraine, a semi-functioning, you couldn't say completely functioning country, a semi-functioning country, semi-free, that Russia just took over a section of it without any provocation. So there's a vast moral difference, even as bad as American foreign policy is, and it is bad, it's terrible. There's a vast moral difference between the two.
And I think just to add one thing to that, it's not only, which is a significant thing, it's not only that they invade countries. It's they're trying to manipulate other countries' elections, their disinformation campaigns, and they're trying to export their control over people to other countries. So there's a kind of method to what Russia's foreign policy is doing, which is not at all, I mean, I agree with your criticisms of American foreign policy and even more. It's important to look at the details of what the Putin regime is about. And I think it to stress even more than what you did, it's like, what is it like to be in Russia, to live in Russia? What kind of society is it? And it's heading fast toward full-on fascism and dictatorship. I mean, that is a significant part of a moral appraisal of any country. And you can't just say, okay, well, we've got that, but what about foreign policy? Yeah, that's the primary. Then foreign policy is another feature that you have to look at. And it's a significant, significant issue.
Can I continue?
Well, why don't
we... If it's very short.
Oh, we'll do.
Very quick, and then we go to that.
Yeah, basically, succession has happened in the Balkans a lot during the last 30 years, right? Yugoslavia, Croatia, Bosnia, and stuff like that. So what you're saying is that USA took no part in those. No bribing, no nothing. No weapon smuggling, no starting of the conflicts,
Again, I'm not going to defend every act of the United States in foreign policy, but again, the comparison between the United States and Russia is incomparable. If we want to do a debate criticizing U.S. foreign policy, I'm happy to participate, and I'm happy to engage it, and I've been critical of the way the United States handled itself in the Balkans from the beginning. But, okay, but that doesn't make it the same as Putin. You know, it's a completely different phenomenon. And by the way, when the United States did that, it did that, at least intentionally, with the intent of more freedom, not less. Now, I think they screwed it up. I think they shouldn't have done it to begin with. They shouldn't have intervened. And I won't defend that policy. But you can't make those comparisons. Now, neither one is, you know, if you want black and white.
No one is clean, that's for sure. But it was the point. Hold on a second.
Now let's get another question.
Sorry, there are two people behind you. I'd like to get them in.
People.
And we want your questions, so come back at the next Q&A or the next session. So let's get both of these questions. Are there three? Okay. So let's do it this way.
Let's take all three.
Take all three very, very briefly, and we'll try to rapid fire get to them. And if it's not a sufficient answer, just follow up separately, okay?
Okay.
Thanks.
Hi. Listening to your lectures, it's pretty obvious that you don't like Christianity. And that you believe that, objectivism is it's better than Christianity, which is obvious. But I want to ask you how you evaluate Jesus' teachings and early Christians from the perspective of their time and place they were living. So was it step forward or step backwards from perspective of those times?
Okay, thank you. Let's take the next question. We'll
answer
them.
We're going to take all three questions and then we'll answer them.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, I have quite a long question, but I will try.
If you'd like to save it for the next session, that's fine too.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, don't be discouraged.
Hi, I have the question about the foreign policy. You have mentioned Libya as an example of the anarchy in the modern world. And I'm thinking about if it would be better if the regime of Gaddafi will be continued, because still, despite like all the terror. the Libyans had the chance to have like the good medicine and education and so on. So that's it. Thank you.
Do you want to talk about Jesus first and then Libya? Two very bright subjects and
Jesus.
Cheerful.
Jesus.
You get Jesus Christ.
Jesus.
No, I don't. I don't want to do Jesus.
Step
forward.
Do you want to do Jesus?
I mean, I'll do it in a wide sense. Yeah. So if a step forward means what is culturally available, not just in this little town or so, you have the whole Greek world. Yeah. And you have Greek philosophy that hasn't been lost yet. And the idea that Jesus is better than Aristotle, or even that he's better than Plato, I don't think so at all. So in that sense, no, there was way better views you could get in morality if you had some ability to get the currency of what intellectually is there.
Pardon? There was no
internet back then. If you're like a peasant, and you might not have that, but if you're a scholar who has some books and so on, you have way better views than Jesus' views.
Yeah, but it's not even clear that Jesus is an improvement over Judaism. So even for the peasant in the particular land, it's not clear to me that qua guidance to life, qua politics, I think it's superior and it succeeded, obviously, much, much greater because it was universal. But in terms of guidance to life, I'm not sure it's an improvement. And I'm actually pretty convinced it's not an improvement, even over Judaism, that was pretty dominant in that part of the world at the time.
And if you take seriously that it's the message is the world's going to end, prepare for it. It's not a guide to life at all. It's a guide to death.
So foreign policy. Look, you know, places... This is the problem with foreign policy, is the United States has none. It doesn't know what it's doing. It's a mess. It intervenes where it shouldn't intervene, and it intervenes in ways that it shouldn't intervene in. It gets in, and it doesn't know when to get out. See Afghanistan right now. It gets in, and it leaves too quickly. See other places. So I think Libya's a mess. It's a disaster with Gaddafi, and it's a disaster without Gaddafi. And to a large extent, it's not clear why the United States ever went in there and why it was involved at all with that. Certainly, it's not clear why it went in there given the outcome, given the way they handled it and the way they left it alone. So here, let me just recommend a book that Ilan Giono edited and wrote quite a bit of it, Winning the Unwinnable War. Because at least in that book, what you'll get, you won't get specifics about Libya, but you'll get our approach to foreign policy. You'll get how we approached, particularly in the Middle East, how we approached the post-9/11 kind of world. And so it's Winning the Unwinnable War. Ilan is the editor, and it's available on Amazon or anywhere else. And there you'll get the principles, if not the specific answer to your question, because the principles to develop that is a big deal for Q&A.
And two quick things on Libya, I can't resist.
Go for it.
I agree. America has no foreign policy, but what takes its place, so what fills the vacuum, is the moral assumptions that we've been talking about all day. The altruist ideas about what is right and wrong, and it shapes American foreign policy. Now, it's not conceptualized as we're missionaries and we're going to cruise. I mean, George Bush was sort of the closest to that in terms of crusading for democracy. But the reason to think about foreign policy in this way is it's directly relevant to our theme, which is we need to get rid of bad ideas because their consequences are incredibly destructive. If you want to understand why American foreign policy is such a mess and why it has caused so much harm in the last 20 years at least, then you need to understand that it's fundamentally shaped by altruism, by the moral ideas of self-sacrifice. It's not the only factor, but it's the primary causal factor explaining why it's such a mess. We went to Iraq, or America went to Iraq on a crusade for democracy, to bring the Iraqis democracy. It's not because we were going to benefit from it. There was some talk about, there's a sort of a ripple effect to us, but that was not really the story that they believed. What was really about, it was these people are poor, they're oppressed, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to serve them. And then the other quick thing about Libya directly, I agree, it was bad with Gaddafi and it's bad without him. But to understand why it's so bad and why it collapsed into anarchy is to understand what happens in a dictatorship. So one of the features of Gaddafi's regime was to completely destroy individual freedom and to completely destroy all the institutions that exist in a free society. You could not have clubs. You could not have debating societies. You cannot have any kind of organization like unions or any kind of membership organization that was not sanctioned by the state. And as a result, when there's the breakdown of authoritarian control, you get anarchy because people don't know how to deal with each other. And there was no way for them to rebuild. They didn't have either the institutions or the knowledge of what it looks like for a properly running society. So, I mean, this is just another way of thinking about the huge importance of having the right ideas shape a society, and why the trend that you were talking about, Yaron, which is sort of the reversion back to authoritarianism in the West, where we know better. I mean, that's what it looks like. I mean, the full-on version of it. Go look at Gaddafi. It's a case study of what happens under authoritarianism, and it is horrific. Thank you all. We'll take a break now.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.